Psalm 78, and let us read verses 1 through 8. Maskil of Asaph, give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and might not be as fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright and whose spirit was not steadfast with God. Thus ends the reading of God's holy and inspired word. Now this morning we come to begin a number of courses, four courses, on the progress of Christ's kingdom, or church history. This Lord's Day we'll begin our study in ancient church history, and we'll begin this morning with an introduction to church history in general before we begin next Lord's Day morning to begin to consider ancient history in particular. Now, I thought Psalm 78, verses 1 through 8, might be an appropriate place for us to begin. Notice in verse 1, the psalmist calls God's people to listen up. He informs them in verses 2 and 3 that he's going to tell them about old and about true stories, things that had been told to him and his generation by their fathers, and things that were to be passed on, obviously, to the children of the rising generation. He suggests that that's what he will do and what we will do in verse 4, that he'll show the next generation the praises of the Lord, his strength, and his wonderful works. In other words, he will speak of God's attributes as they're displayed in providence and bring forth praise from them. He also informs us that God has established a testimony, he's appointed a law in verse 5, and that it is our responsibility, the responsibility of the present generation, to make known this testimony and this law to their children. This whole law suggests the covenantal relationship which God has established with his people. We know that it's not rules versus relationship, but we realize that relationships have rules attached to them. And so God's covenant relationship with his people involves rules as well as blessings and curses as those rules are either followed or not followed. But the psalmist Asaph goes on to say that these laws should be passed on and on and on down through the generations in verse 6. That, he says in verses 7 and 8. And here I believe we have a biblical basis to understand the uses, the applications of church history. Asaph says positively in verse 7 that church history, God's laws as well as his providential dealings with his people should be taught the rising generation so that, first, they might set their hope in God. Secondly, that they might not forget the works of God. That's really faith, isn't it? So that their hope might be strengthened, that their faith might be strengthened, that thirdly, they would keep God's commandments. In other words, that they would express their love to God for his great deliverance of them and relationship with him by keeping his commandments. It reminds us of the words of our Lord in John 14:15, where we read, if ye love me, keep my commandments. So we have three positive usages or applications of church history in verse 7, that the hope and faith and love of those taught might be increased. But then we see the negative of church history, that these that are taught might not be stubborn and rebellious, that they might not set their heart for wrong, but might set their heart aright, and that their spirit would be steadfast with God rather than not steadfast with God, not fulfilling their covenantal responsibility to the Lord their God. So I thought this might be an appropriate passage as we begin this morning to introduce church history. And this morning, what I'd like to do is not give a philosophy of history or the basics of history. I have done a lecture on that subject. You could find that lecture on sermonaudio.com if you type in my name, Tim Worrell, and look up Christian Education number 7. You will find a lecture on philosophy, a biblical philosophy of history, obviously in a survey form. But you could do that. But today, I want us to focus primarily upon church history, or history as it relates to God's dealings with His church in particular. Now, this morning, we want to look at the nature of church history. Then we'll consider, secondly, the sources of church history. Then we'll consider the periods of church history. And then we'll move on to consider the branches or the areas that will warrant a certain degree of coverage as we march our way through church history. And then fifth and lastly, we'll consider some of the uses of church history, or some of the benefits, how we can apply church history or the study of church history to our own spiritual good. So let's begin with the nature of church history. I think the first thing we have to do is recognize that there is a divine side to history and church history, as well as a creaturely side, a human side, but also a demonic side. As we consider the divine side, we must remember that age-old mnemonic that history is His story. History is ultimately God's story. It's ultimately the fulfilling of the plan that God has established for history before time even began. It's really nothing more than a study of the providential dealings of God. Consider Shorter Catechism question 11 and the answer, particularly of question 11. God's works of providence are His most holy, wise, powerful preserving and governing all His creatures and all their actions. So ultimately God is in charge of history. It is His story. And yet when we consider Job chapter 1, we're reminded that God does allow people to sin and does allow Satan to tempt men to sin or to bring chastisement or bring very difficult situations upon them, as God allowed Satan to be involved in the pruning of Job in the book of Job. Remember in the Westminster Confession of Faith in chapter 5 on providence, the divine say in paragraph 2 that He, God, ordereth them, ordereth His decrees to fall out according to the nature of secondary causes. God in His providence ordinarily allows things to take place through acts of men and even acts of demons. So we consider the human side of God, of history, and try to consider it with the divine side. We certainly are reminded of the kingdom parables in Matthew 13. We learn a little bit of history and what we can expect in terms of the church and its how it interacts with the world. Particularly consider the parables of the leaven, the mustard seed, and the dough in Matthew 13:24 through 33. We see in those parables, a parallel growth of good and evil. The church growing, but the world growing as well. And we see a continual antithesis, a continual battle between the two. We also see the mutual influence of the church on the culture. And then, reverse way side, culture, worldly culture often influencing the church for evil. And then we really can't forget the book of Revelation. Book of Revelation clearly reminds us of what is going on and will go on in heaven and earth through this period of the last days, this New Testament epoch leading up to the final day of the Lord, the final day of judgment after the Lord himself returns in glory. So, just a little thought, a couple thoughts there about the nature of church history before we move in to consider the sources of church history. We could speak of infallible sources and fallible sources, or in other words, divine sources and human sources of history. Well, certainly when we're reading history books, we need to recognize that what is written isn't necessarily what actually happened, much less is the explanation for why such things happen necessarily accurate. But we can be assured that the things, the events that are told in the Scripture are true, and when God is pleased to help us understand why they've taken place, He's chosen to give us a level of detail in that regard. Think about the book of Obadiah, where God prophesies the destruction of the people of Edom, which indeed did take place by the Babylonians and later under the Maccabees. But it is interesting that he does provide primarily for the consolation of the Jewish people, the rationale for the destruction of the Edomites, particularly their pride as well as their cruelty. So there's certainly an infallible and fallible sources. There are certainly written sources versus oral sources. But as we consider church history from around the period of 70 AD or 100 on to the present, we don't have infallible sources regarding that period of history, and certainly we have very few oral sources that we can get to, even though some of the written sources that we would consider obviously have their roots in oral sources, in things being passed down by generation to generation regarding the events of the past. As we consider written sources, I think we ought to see that there are such things as primary sources and then secondary sources. Let me give you a couple examples of primary sources. When we speak of primary sources, we could be speaking of official documents. An example is in the Creeds of Christendom by Philip Schoff. We can find out what actual creeds, the words of the very creeds of the church in the ancient period, as well as in latter periods of church history. So official documents are certainly helpful. Private writings can be very helpful. Here before us we have the 48 volumes of the Fathers. But again, when you read whoever, let's say Origen, and we read of his view of certain things, a private writing only tells us that that's his view, where if we read a view let's say, the Chalcedonian Creed, we at least understand that that was a consensus position of the men that represented the church in that council. And so certainly we have a little bit better sense of consensus views in official documents rather than in private writings. But we also have eyewitness chroniclers. Maybe a good example would be Eusebius, who wrote Ecclesiastical History, one of the first church histories available to us, and certainly something that we could consider. But then we also have to consider whether there's some bias in sources even like that. It's certainly fairly obvious to many that Eusebius, being on the scene at the time of Constantine, certainly saw the glory days of the church in Constantine and his reign, and viewed everything from the past in light of that. So he was certainly a man of his times. One other thing we need to consider about primary sources are also archaeological findings. So they can be very helpful to better understand what was taking place, what the actual cultural artifacts tell us. But as we mentioned, there are primary sources, but there are also secondary sources. Certainly the textbook that we'll be using, R.B. Kuyper, The History of the Church, is a secondary source. And so when we consider secondary sources, we need to ask the question, what makes a good secondary source? The official writings of the creeds, they are as good as they are. They are what they are. The private writings of the fathers, they are what they are. History books of the past, though they may be filled with biases, we have to ask ourselves, when we consider those kind of sources, do they reference primary sources? Do they speak to historians of the very period in which they are writing? And do they refer to official documents or private writings that we can get to? Secondly, we have to make sure that they are using good logic, that they are making good and necessary deductions from the facts that they present. Just because they present a few facts that are accurate does not mean that they have necessarily connected the dots regarding those facts accurately, and we must evaluate the logical deductions that they draw from the facts that they present after having validated that the facts they presented are indeed factual. Now, we also need to ask ourselves the question when we consider secondary sources, what do we need to consider as we approach them? I think we need to, at best we can, understand the philosophical apologetical perspective of the writer or writers, as well as their theological perspective. Certainly if we are considering reading Philip Schaff in his History of the Church, we need to recognize Philip Schaff's theological perspectives. We need to recognize that he doesn't come exactly from our camp, but has a broader Lutheran, semi-liberal perspective on things. Even when we consider our own textbook, R.B. Kuyper, we'll recognize that our author is a Dutchman, and because of that doesn't seem to give as much weight to the British Isles and America that we would probably desire. We also recognize that R.B. Kuyper wrote this book in a time period when generally history was names and dates, and we'll see that the book leans in that direction maybe more than some of us would desire, and sometimes because of that neglects some of the greater ideas, some of the what we would call historical theology, you know, what the theologians of the time were coming to understand and how they were interacting with one another. And how those theologians were interacting with the culture in general. Some of that will be lacking from our textbook, and we will attempt at times to bring in additional material to supplement the textbook in the areas that I've just mentioned. So having covered the sources, the nature of church history as well as the sources, now let's consider the periods of church history. And this will basically help us to understand the four courses, the four quarters of courses that we will be studying over the next year in Christian education class. The first period is the ancient church history period. We can say this period begins either at 70 AD, the destruction of Jerusalem, or maybe at 100, the death of the last apostle, the Apostle John. And this period runs to 590, at the establishment of Gregory as the Pope of Rome. Now, there are many that would seek to claim that there were popes in Rome before Gregory. I think it's more accurate to say that there were bishops or archbishops, but that it wasn't really until 590 that the papal authority, as we understand it, was really in place. And so in this ancient period, we'll consider really the dynamic of persecution and popularity. We'll find that the beginning of this period leading up to the conversion of Constantine was a period predominantly of persecution. We'll certainly consider some of the theology of that point time, and worship and life, but for the main, we'll speak much of the persecution of that period. But then following Constantine's conversion and eventually legalizing Christianity, and then later it actually being authorized, promoted, we'll see that Christianity became popular, and we'll see that that was good in many ways, but there obviously were temptations for the people of God in that situation as well. So that's what we'll be studying over the next 13 weeks, the ancient church history period. Following that, we'll consider the medieval history. We'll consider that period of history from 590, the establishment of Gregory as the Pope of Rome, up till 517, that year when Martin Luther wrote the 95 Theses and posted them on a church door in Wittenberg, Germany, seeking to debate the particular subject of indulgences, the practice of indulgences. We'll see during this period, which has sometimes been called the Dark Ages, and in some ways was dark, but oftentimes there was more light there than we might have, than many church historians may have originally thought. And we'll look at some of the darker things in the church life, as well as some of the brighter stars of that period. But we will see the dynamic that there's a great confusion in this period regarding is the church in charge of the state, or is the church state in charge of the church? Neither one being biblical, but we'll see that there's a constant upheaval in those views, particularly in the West, where in the Eastern Church it seems that the East was satisfied with a doctrinal view that the church reported to the state. And many contend that that's why things were quite quiet and why things liberalized theologically much more quickly in the Eastern Church than the West. So we'll be considered things like the Crusades, as well as the Eastern Orthodox Church and its interactions with the Western Church, the growth of the papacy, the theological developments of the time through men like Alcuin of York, Anselm of Canterbury, as well as Thomas Aquinas, probably the greatest theologian of the medieval period. We'll also, in that period, consider monasticism at some level, and the works and life of Bernard of Clairvaux. But then, thirdly, we'll consider the Reformation church history period from 517 to 1790, from that nailing of the 95 Theses on the wall or on the door at the Wittenberg Church up to the French Revolution. And really the Enlightenment period, which was anything but enlightening. We'll find, as we consider that period, that the Enlightenment really was the bringing on of the Dark Ages and leading to a dynamic of growth in the church, but then also a very downward growth in that which is not the church, in the broad culture. We'll see a growing nationalism developing, a period of the Renaissance at the end of the medieval period, calling for a return to the original writings, to Ad Fontes, leading to men like Erasmus of Rotterdam translating the New Testament in Greek, from Greek, from the original Greek, and we'll find that this leads to a breaking with Rome. And we'll also consider in the Reformation period, certainly the high watermark of the Reformation period, the establishment of the Westminster Assembly and its documents, various documents that it produced, really what we believe to be the high watermark of creedal Christianity. And we believe that ever since that period, things have been on a slide. And then, certainly the fourth period of church history is the modern church history period. From 1790, the French Revolution or the Enlightenment, up till the present. And the dynamic here will mainly be how rationalism has taken over philosophically and has ultimately led to an irrational philosophy that is anti-God, and just the basic antithesis between the church and the world, and how the world has significantly impacted the church in this period. We certainly could consider a fifth period, which many today believe we have entered into, and that is the postmodern period, a period where there's almost no rationalism left. Everything is irrational. Many believe this is what has led to the churches being influenced by the emerging church and its development, really out of this postmodern irrational philosophy that dominates the scene today. But having spoken of the four church history periods, I think it's appropriate for us to spend just a few minutes to consider the branches of church history, or the areas that we will tend to focus on as we work through these periods of history. The first is, we'll consider the history of missions, or the extension of the church. Clearly, in this ancient church history period, we'll consider the extension of the church through the apostles, as well as consider the extension of the church through the testimony and witness to the barbarian hordes who came into the Roman Empire and who were ultimately brought at least to an external conversion and came under the influence of Christianity in significant numbers. We'll also, in all these periods, consider the history of the interaction with the world that I have alluded to. We'll see how the church has affected politics and philosophy, and how politics and philosophy have affected the church. Clearly, in this ancient church history period, we'll see how Greek philosophy flowing through the Jew Philo led to many of the early heresies of the church. We'll also see how that kind of thing led to men like Tertullian holding nearly a fideism, which would believe faith only and no reason, or Origen apparently holding a position of rationalism, being very comfortable with Greek thought and allowing Greek thought to mold, particularly Platonic thought, dualistic thought, to significantly impact his theology. And then we'll find someone like Augustine, really the very cream of the crop of the ancient period, seeking to hold the middle ground and saying, I believe that I may understand, placing faith not in opposition to reason, but prior to reason, and reason falling in place after faith. So we'll consider some of the influences of Greek philosophy as we work through theology of the ancient period. Also, in all these periods, we'll consider the history of worship. Particularly in the ancient church history period, we'll see that in the period of persecution of the church, up till the time of the conversion of Constantine, corporate worship was very simple, modeled very closely after the church of the apostolic period, which very closely followed the pattern of the Old Testament synagogues. But then not only will we consider the history of missions or church extension, the history of the interaction of the church with the world and the history of worship, we'll also consider the history of doctrine, what is sometimes called historical theology. Particularly in the ancient church history period, we'll consider the development of the doctrine of the Trinity and doctrines related to the person of Christ and his being both 100% God and 100% man, also discussing his incarnation. We'll note that these doctrines were developed in this period in response to errors that had arisen. And we'll see that God in his providence often uses errors to stir his church up to a greater accuracy of expression regarding the truth of his word. We'll also see that in this ancient church history period, growing perspective or view of baptismal regeneration and the absolute need to be a member of Mother Church, where the sacraments are administered and where grace is conveyed through those sacraments. We'll see that these kind of teachings will dominate the medieval period. It really won't be until the Reformation period that the doctrine of free grace that Augustine held will triumph over the doctrine, the false doctrine of baptismal regeneration in the church. So, the history of missions, the history of interaction with the world, the history of worship, the history of doctrine, we'll also consider the history of church government. We'll see particularly in this ancient church history period that church government was relatively simple in the apostolic period, but then we see this growing super shepherd position where bishops begin to behave and there's an establishment of bishops rather than just pastors. See the beginning of a hierarchy that will lead to ultimately patriarchs and archbishops in the churches of the biggest cities in the known world at the time. We'll also see a growing encroachment of the civil government upon the church. We'll see church offices being bought in the medieval period, as well as the civil government seeking to dominate and encroach in the church area, in the area of the church, or the sphere of the church. And sixthly and lastly, as we consider the history of the church, we'll also consider the history of church life, of regular Christian living in the period. What were the emphases? What were the things that were emphasized that were right? What were the things that were emphasized that were wrong? We'll see in the ancient church history period that marriage, though practiced by many, was certainly viewed as that for second-class Christians. We'll see that the monastic views of singleness, of celibacy, of poverty, and the like promoted an unbiblical view of possessions and attire. Also an unbiblical view, really, of labor and the sanctity of labor, as well as the sanctity of marriage. So we've considered the nature of church history. We've looked at the sources of church history, focusing primarily on the written sources, primary and secondary, the periods of church history, ancient church history, medieval church history, Reformation church history, modern church history, as well as the six branches of church history, the themes that we'll focus on: missions, interaction with the world, worship, doctrine, church government, as well as church life. And so with those, let us close as we consider the uses of church history, or the benefits of church history, basically answering the question, why study church history? Now, let me give you six answers to the question why we should study church history. First is to grow in understanding God's providence and Christ's messianic rule in the church. If we look at Colossians 1:16 through 18, we find that Christ is the head of the church, and yet he is the one who was active in creation, who is active in providence, and who rules over all. And so we will see that there's this relationship, this interrelationship between what we often call secular history and sacred history. Secondly, we study church history to grow in faith, hope, and love. Remember Psalm 78, verse 7. These things will be passed on to the future generations, as the psalmist Asaph says in verse 7, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments. So not only do we study church history to understand God's providence and Christ's messianic rule, we also do so to grow in faith, hope, and love. Would also contend that we study church history that grow in our appreciation of our forefathers. We are in desperate need in our day to more fully appreciate the church's influence on Western culture. But we also need to appreciate Western Catholic tradition. We're not Latter-day Saints. We don't believe the church started in 1517 with Luther. We recognize that there is a distinction between Catholic tradition, or the universal tradition of the church, and Roman Catholic tradition. Hope you recognize that Roman Catholic is an oxymoron. A church cannot be universal or Catholic and be Roman at the same time. But we'll also, through church history, have a growing appreciation for Protestant tradition. Traditions that were expanded the Catholic tradition of the ancient period. And then lastly, we also need to appreciate other branches of the church. But we need to appreciate particularly our own branch of the church. I think it was Miller who so accurately said that it is so odd in his time in the mid-1800s that almost Christians from all other denominations were very enthusiastic about their own denominations, and yet it seemed to him that the Presbyterians were not very enthusiastic or did not appreciate their own branch of the church. But I think we need to. I think we need to be reminded of the Apostle Paul's command in Philippians 3:16, where to we have already attained, let us walk by the same rule, let us mind the same thing. We're called to remember what God has given us and to maintain that which we as God's people have attained to, to not fall back from the attainments that have been made by God's church, by His Reformed and Presbyterian church, by His grace. So not only do we study church history to grow in the understanding of providence and Christ's messianic rule, to grow in faith, hope, and love, to grow in appreciation to our forefathers, but we also grow, we also study church history to grow downward in humility. When we study church history, we will learn about the good as well as the bad and the ugly. If you remember in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 11 and following, Paul reminds us that the sordid history of God's people through the wilderness wanderings were there and are there for us as a warning that we might not fall into the same sins. And so church history certainly affords us an opportunity to grow in humility, to be weary, lest we think we stand, lest we fall. Fifthly, we should study church history to grow in our ability to serve in the church. Certainly an understanding of church history will enhance our ability to minister around the world to different races and religions. We must and we ought to know the times. Oh, that more men were like the men of Issachar of old, who, it says in 1 Chronicles 12:32, were men who had understanding of the times and knew what Israel ought to do. Matthew Henry, commenting on Daniel 5, 10 and following, says that we might understand aright what God is doing with us, it is of use to us to review what He has done with others. We want to understand what God's doing with us as His church today. Matthew Henry contends we need to know what God has been doing with His church through the ages. It was Edmund Burke, the conservative political theorist, who said, "Those who don't know history are destined to repeat it." And then a secularist, Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World, said this, that men do not learn much from the lessons of history is the most important of all the lessons of history. And it's so sad that quite often we have failed to learn the lessons of history, and they indeed have been repeated. And so we need to take note that to fail to learn from history will lead to repeating history for the worse. One other thing, sixthly, that is certainly a reason why we study church history, is that we might be more heavenly minded. Paul calls us to that. He calls us to have our thoughts in the heavenly places in Colossians 3, 1 and 2. I'm sure you've heard the saying that some are too heavenly minded to be of any earthly good. I hope you recognize that is nonsense. That is not true. That perspective is from the pit itself, from Satan himself. Consider the words of C.S. Lewis in closing this morning. C.S. Lewis said, "If you read history, you will find that the Christians who did most for the present world were precisely those who thought most of the next. It is, since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world, that they have become so ineffective in this." As we, over the next 52 weeks, consider God's providential dealings in the history of the church, let us not be only minded of what's going on the earth, but let us allow our thoughts to rise above the events of history and place our minds in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus our Lord. Let us close in prayer.